by Jeremy Shear, with help from Kevin Volp at the University of Pennsylvania. There are hundreds more moments of science on our website at amos.indiana.edu. To get podcasts, click on the podcast button. Once again, our web address, amos.indiana.edu, and for podcasts, click on the podcast button. For a moment of science, I'm Don Glass.
And I'm Yael Cassander.
It's 2:41. St. Louis Blues principal owner Dave Checketts is heading a group that wants to buy the NFL's Rams and keep the team in St. Louis. A spokesman for Checketts confirmed today that Checketts leads a group of investors interested in purchasing the St. Louis Rams. Game 3 of the best-of-7 Stanley Cup Finals will be played tonight in Pittsburgh. The Penguins dropped the first two games to the defending champion Red Wings in Detroit. Chicago Bulls assistant coach Del Harris is retiring from basketball after 50 years of coaching. Harris is 71 years old and just finished his first season working with Bulls coach Vinny Del Negro. Harris began his NBA coaching career as an assistant with the Houston Rockets in 1976. He's also coached on the international, college, and high school levels. Cincinnati will try to win back-to-back games in St. Louis for the first time in 3 years when Cincinnati and St. Louis continue their four-game series. St. Louis's Brad Thompson is set to make his first start of the season. Chicago Cubs pitcher Randy Wells will try again for his first major win of the season when he faces Atlanta today. Wells is 0-2 this season, and he's starting in place of Carlos Zambrano, who suspended after an outburst last week against Pittsburgh. And the White Sox hope for another strong effort from Bartolo Colon, whose start was pushed back one day so he could get extra rest. Colon is 3-4 heading into tonight's game against Oakland in Chicago. That's sports.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy the summer studio theater production of I Am My Own Wife, starring Henson Keys, that will be playing during June. More information is at KrannertCenter.com.
A severe thunderstorm watch is in effect for Champaign, Christian, Clark, Coles, Cumberland, DeWitt, Douglas, Edgar, Logan, Macon, Moultrie, Piatt, Sangamon, and Shelby, and Vermilion counties in the WILL severe weather coverage area. The watch continues until 8 o'clock tonight. The troubled economy has been especially unkind to the village of Ellsworth, Michigan, and the roughly 500 people who live there. The county's unemployment rate hovers around 16%. But as Jennifer Guerra of Michigan Radio reports, when the last place in town to grab a bite closed, the residents came up with a novel plan.
I'm standing at the corner of Main Street and Center Street. It's pretty much considered downtown Ellsworth. If you look around, there are vacant storefronts everywhere. There's the old bait shop that closed up a few months ago. Down the street is the Ellsworth Grocery and Deli that shut down about a year ago. Even the used car lot is pretty empty. It's only got 4 cars for sale. So it's pretty quiet here in Ellsworth. That is, until you step inside a place called the Front Porch Cafe.
On any given morning, you can find half the town sitting at the tables and booths inside. Some of them are here for the $5 breakfasts.
What would you like?
I would like full order biscuits and gravy.
Okay.
Can I also get an egg over easy on top?
You sure can.
Some are here for a slice of homemade pie.
We have coconut, peanut butter, chocolate cream, lemon meringue.
And the group of old-timers in the back. Well, ever since the cafe opened last fall, they've been here every single morning for coffee. Larry Essenberg admits they haven't always had it this good.
I mean, the bait shop served just coffee. And pre-made stuff, I guess you'd call it.
You got the leftover minnows.
You heard right, the bait shop. That's where they used to meet for coffee after the Ellsworth Diner closed early last year and the Ellsworth Grocery and Deli a couple weeks after that.
It was just kind of depressing.
That's Bob Felton. He's in charge of outreach at the local Christian Reformed Church. He said the town desperately needed a place where neighbors could catch up with one another, preferably over a decent cup of coffee and a cheap meal. So he decided it was time for the church to get into the restaurant business.
We kind of have this joke at church that if you want to get people together, bring food. And early on, as we presented the vision to people, there were some who said, I would never start a restaurant anytime, let alone in this kind of an economic climate. And from our perspective, that was a perfect time to do it.
See, the Front Porch Cafe is a nonprofit and non-denominational restaurant. Aside from the cook staff, everyone who works here is a volunteer. The waiters, busboys, hosts. Bob Vollmer volunteers on Thursdays. He owns the used car lot across the street and says ever since the cafe opened, people from all over Michigan have come through town.
Two people from Charlevoix came over and had breakfast here. None of them had intended to buy a car that day. It wasn't a reason to come to Ellsworth, but by the end of the day, they had come back and bought a car.
Nobody thinks one small nonprofit cafe and a couple used car sales can resuscitate a town like Ellsworth. Some say it could just be postponing the inevitable. But John Hastings says the cafe can make a difference. He's the town's undertaker and volunteers at the cafe.
When this place is closed, the town is absolutely, you could shoot a cannon down the street.
The church-sponsored cafe is open every day except, no surprise here, on Sundays. For NPR News, I'm Jennifer Guerra.
The biggest book convention in North America wrapped up over the weekend in New York City. Much of the buzz this year at Book Expo USA was about how the recession has hurt the publishing industry. But one genre, the romance novel, is doing quite well, and that includes ethnic romances. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates has this appreciation of Elsie B. Washington, the woman who started the ball rolling with the first contemporary African-American romance novel. Elsie B. Washington passed away last month.
Some people sneer at paperback romance novels, but they're the most prolific, profitable arm of the publishing industry. And until 1980, all the damsels being clasped to hard male chests were white. Lots of passion, zilch diversity. Then, under the pen name Rosalind Wells, journalist Elsie Washington published Entwined Destinies. It's widely considered the first contemporary black romance. Gwendolyn Osborne is a contributor to The Romance Reader, a popular website for online reviews. She recaps the storyline.
Entwined Destinies was the story of an African-American magazine writer who is sent to London to cover an oil conference, and she meets this African-American man, Lloyd Craig, who is part of a multinational oil conglomerate.
Sparks fly in short order, but for the first time, they were flying between people of color and means. Janice Sims had been trying to publish her own black romance back then with no luck.
Nobody was interested in my books. I couldn't find anyone who was publishing African-American stories with African-American hero and heroine who were, let's put it this way, upwardly mobile, not from the ghetto or anything, you know what I mean?
Washington's work, populated as it was with well-educated, well-traveled, worldly blacks, was a delight to black readers and aspiring writers. Driving to Book Expo, Rochelle Allers told me she could still recall her elation at discovering this trailblazing book.
It's almost like what people felt when Barack Obama was elected president. You know, they said, you know, we can do this. And that's what I felt when I saw Elsie's book.
Allers, who has now sold almost 2 million books, says she was just as thrilled to see Washington's cover.
Oh, my God. The people on the cover look like me.
That was a definite difference. Guided by Vivian Stevens, the first black romance editor, Washington spun a tale with all the traditional romance elements. Attraction, longing, obstacles to overcome, and ultimately commitment set against a glamorous international backdrop. Suddenly, black wasn't only poor or pathological. It wasn't just victims. Gwen Osborne.
The important thing about Elsie's work is that it established the romance novels that followed in the next 20 years as books about the African-American middle class.
In fact, Washington brought the black middle class front and center before the Huxtables became America's favorite black TV family. Entwined Destinies was Washington's first and only novel. It's now out of print, but its effects are still being felt by the current crop of successful black romance novelists like Allers and Sims. Sims says Washington's work inspired her to expand her own boundaries.
She really opened that up for me. And I know she did the same thing for a lot of other African-American romance novelists.
Elsie Washington died in New York on May 5th after a long illness. She was 66 years old. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
When schools get too crowded, school administrators often resort to placing students in modular classrooms. Essentially, they're trailers. But Cheryl Rich Kern reports some innovative architects are saying the energy savings and efficiency of modulars make them an ideal and often permanent solution.
I've actually taught a class in one of those temporary portable classrooms. It was in the early morning at a community college. Students would walk in droopy-eyed. My job was to keep them engaged and awake. Not an easy task. The room was either too hot or too cold, and the ventilation system made weird noises. But some experts say portables don't have to be that way. They can be the kind of room that educators actually prefer. Michelle Gould is a teacher and parent at the Carroll School in Lincoln, Massachusetts, and she teaches in a new kind of portable classroom.
The air is very clean in here. It smells like the outside. It doesn't smell like air conditioning or heating. The lighting, I think, is very good for not working under natural light. It seems like you're outside, and it makes a big difference tutoring kids.
Did you write your last name, Will?
No.
No? Okay. Very good, nice spacing. You can close your book and put your pencils down.
The Carroll School's main building is a brick mansion from the early 1900s. It is stately, elegant. The portable next to it is not. It's boxy and has a flat white roof. Kind of ugly. But when you walk into the portable, you feel a change. It's comfortable. Cliff Cord is president of Triumph Modular, the firm that leases the country's first green portable classroom.
This is a vestibule that we think is a necessary ingredient to almost all buildings because it controls the weather from the outside to the inside.
Vestibules aren't typically found in modular classrooms. Neither is the paperless drywall that eliminates mold or the sensors that learn the best way to control the heating.
If the teacher tends to come in early on Mondays, the building would begin to learn her habits and then turn on the heating or air conditioning just before she gets here. And if they start to take off half a day on Wednesdays, then the building would start to learn that no one's here in the afternoons and they could shut down. So it helps manage the use of the HVAC system.
Court points to the dome skylights, known as sun tunnels, which bring in daylight.
But they don't bring it in a way that's too harsh. They're, as you can see, this is screened a bit, so it's diffused light.
Triumph Modular is just one of the companies making these more environmentally friendly modular classrooms. Tom Hardiman is director of the Modular Building Institute, a trade association for dealers and manufacturers of commercial modular buildings.
Improved acoustics, improved daylighting, there are countless studies out there that show that that does improve the learning environment.
Hardiman says many of the old-style portable classrooms end up being used for 20 or 30 years. The problem is, they weren't meant to. But higher-end portables, like the one in Lincoln, Massachusetts, are built to last. And because of the modular construction, they're greener.
And I'm sure if you've been on a construction site, you've seen dumpster after dumpster of tubifores and drywall and siding sticking out of the dumpsters. There's just not that much waste with modular construction.
Hardiman says that green portables are the wave of the future. They're not the cheapest solution. But Hardiman says they do provide the best learning spaces on campus. For the Environment Report, I'm Cheryl Rich Kern.
If Sonia Sotomayor is confirmed as the next Supreme Court justice, her elevation to the Supreme Court will immediately affect a handful of people. Commentator Amy Guider tells us about Supreme Court justices and their clerks in this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News.
One Supreme Court justice leaves and another one joins the court. When the makeup of the Supreme Court changes, it can affect the course of law in the United States. But more immediately, it affects those recent law school graduates who've agreed to clerk for the outgoing and incoming justices. Here's some background. Law clerks have an important job at the Supreme Court. Each justice usually has only four. These clerks, through something called the certiorari pool, suggest which cases the justices at the Supreme Court should hear. They sometimes draft initial opinions, and they get a bird's-eye view of the way the court works. It's a job that's very, very difficult to get, and one that gives those chosen an impressive gold star for the rest of their lives. It's probably the best job, the job that's most coveted by recent law grads, even though it usually lasts only 1 year. And then the makeup of the Supreme Court changes. I'm reminded of personal history each time a justice retires. My husband was all set to clerk for Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. He had gone through rounds of interviews the year before he was supposed to clerk and had received a call from Justice Marshall himself offering him the job. He was all set to go to work the next week when the Friday before, Justice Marshall called him again to tell him the news that he was retiring. Suddenly, three of the four clerks that Justice Marshall had hired were out of a job, and that included my husband. The fourth clerk would work for the justice in retirement. That's not the same thing as clerking for a sitting justice, but it's still pretty exciting. The three others had to scramble to find work. Admittedly, it's not too much of a scramble because these would-be clerks usually have top grades from top law schools. My husband found a job almost immediately working for a Washington, D.C. law firm. And luckily, he was hired by Justice Byron White to clerk the following year, so he got his Supreme Court clerkship after all. When Justice Souter didn't hire any clerks for the 2009-2010 Supreme Court term, it was a clue that he was thinking of retiring. It also meant that no clerk was out of a job when he confirmed the retirement rumors. As for the incoming justice, those clerks who've agreed to work for her or him, whatever the case may be, are suddenly catapulted from an appellate clerkship into the appellate clerkship. The judges usually hire a year or more in advance, so it's truly an unexpected elevation for those who agreed to a clerkship with a judge in one city and end up clerking for a justice at the nation's highest court in Washington, D.C. The switch is worth it. There are benefits beyond the experience of working at the highest court in the land. Last time I looked, and this was before the economic downturn, Supreme Court clerks received as much as $200,000 as a signing bonus from law firms. That's how much in demand these recent law school grads are. So when a justice on the Supreme Court retires and another one is confirmed, the implications are fairly direct for a handful of people, those who've agreed to work for the now retiree and those who've agreed to work for the appellate judge, who suddenly becomes a household name. I'm Amy Guida.
Amy Guida is an assistant professor of journalism and law at the University of Illinois.
Earth and Sky.
Michael Balick is an ethnobotanist. He studies how people use native plants to maintain their health. He gave an example from the small Micronesian island of Panape in the Western Pacific.
Well, there's a species of cinnamon tree only found on Panape. It's not found anywhere else in the world. And the people there use it to treat back pain. And they make a tea of it.
Balick, who spoke to Earth Sky from his office at the New York Botanical Garden, said his